From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Later on in the program, we'll be looking at the intersection of a modern trend and an ancient religious practice, as Instagram-worthy charcuterie platters have gained popularity for breaking fast among Muslims in the holy month of Ramadan. But first, the Illinois Constitution says the Attorney General shall be the legal officer of the state. With 431 attorneys, if the AG's office was a private law firm, it would be the third largest in Illinois. The office is responsible for consumer protection, environmental law, and representing state government in court, among other duties. And since 2019, the Illinois Attorney General has been Kwame Raoul. A Democrat, Raoul easily won re-election last year. He defeated Republican anti-COVID attorney Tom DeVore by 11 percentage points. Before that, he was a state senator from Chicago. He filled the vacancy created when then-state Senator Barack Obama went off to Washington. In order to accommodate his schedule, I spoke with the Attorney General last week. We talked about a variety of legal challenges facing the state, including ones to the laws banning the sale of assault weapons and eliminating cash bail. We also talked about so-called constitutional sheriffs who've taken it upon themselves rather than the courts to decide what laws to enforce, and the state of what was once a bipartisan push for a more fair and equitable criminal justice system. Because this part of our show is on tape today, we're not taking calls live right now, but you can always let us know what you thought by leaving a voicemail. The number is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. Okay, here now is my interview with Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul. Attorney General Kwame Raoul, welcome to the 21st show. Welcome back, I should say. Thanks for making time to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
So as we talk, there are multiple constitutional challenges to the authority of the General Assembly and the state of Illinois. I want to begin by talking through several of them. And first up is the ban on the future sale of what the law describes as assault weapons. This is being challenged in state and federal court. Your office is defending these laws. Why do you think these laws are constitutional?
Well, first off, the respective challenges challenge the laws from various perspectives. One, depending on which form it's in, there are Second Amendment challenges or challenges with regards to the process the legislature took and so forth. But I think the Second Amendment allows, and the legislature certainly is empowered to put limitations on firearms, particularly those firearms that are designed more for warfare than simple self-protection or sport. And the legislature certainly has within its domain to provide for the public safety of the residents of the state of Illinois. And it should be noted that the United States at the federal level has had assault weapons bans historically. And there have been municipalities that within the state of Illinois that have had assault weapons ban for some years.
Of course, as you know, that federal assault weapons ban, though, predated the U.S. Supreme Court's new-ish, I guess it's not that new anymore, interpretation of the Second Amendment. And I'm sure there are Illinoisans right now who would tell us, hey, the U.S. Constitution says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Why can Illinois say yes, but not these kinds of firearms?
Well, certainly when the framers were drafting the Constitution, these types of firearms did not exist. You had the sort of one-shot rifles that existed at the time. I don't think a strong argument can be made that the framers of the Constitution envisioned the types of weapons with multiple bullet magazines and rapid-fire weapons that exist today were the ones that they contemplated some 200-plus years ago.
We had a black gun rights supporter on the show not long ago from an organization that advocates for the rights of black gun owners, making the point that it's people of color who are disproportionately affected or targeted by these laws. How do you prevent that from happening? Or is that a concern you share, I guess?
That the people of color are targeted by this. There's nothing in the language of these laws that suggests that the laws apply to people of color than any differently than they do to anybody else. So I don't buy into that. that argument.
Well, that's the language, but I think you, like, if a downstate rural sheriffs are saying they're going to, you know, sort of pump the brakes on enforcement, and Cook County goes, or Chicago particularly, goes hard on enforcement, it could have that disproportionate effect in outcome, right?
Well, and hopefully so, because the people of color currently bear the brunt of the harm that's being done by these types of weapons. And so to the extent that we have a better enforcement in Cook County, where a disproportionate amount of the gun violence is taking place in neighborhoods populated predominantly by people of color, certainly we want a law that's aimed at preserving public safety to have that effect of keeping people safe.
I can remember a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing years ago when you were chairing those committee hearings, where somebody had made the case that people who live in the neighborhoods that are most affected by violence and disinvestment and many of the other problems that, that affect neighborhoods in certain neighborhoods in Chicago, they want to be able to carry firearms. And I remember you reacting sort of very angrily, and I probably have some of the details wrong on that. I don't know if you recall this episode, but where are you today? I mean, it's legal, but is carrying a firearm for self-defense something that is a good idea?
You know, I don't know that I weigh in one way or the other. I think we have to distinguish between the right to carry a firearm, which exists within the state of Illinois and in all of the 50 states, and then the types of firearms that are being carried. You know, we've prohibited folks from possessing machine guns for a long time. So nobody's going to argue that people have a right to walk down the street with machine guns, are they? And so the notion that the right to carry exists doesn't mean that limitations can't be put on it. Even Justice Scalia once recognized that limitations can be put upon that right to bear arms.
I also want to ask, I talked with a gun rights supporter. This person said, you know, Democrats can keep passing these laws. We, his side, will keep challenging them. And meanwhile, we're buying more and more weapons. And someday there will be so many firearms in this country that these kinds of laws will be toothless or pointless. I mean, heck, we may be getting close to that point already. What do you say to that? How do you think about that?
You know, I say that it is a responsibility of policymakers to enact policy, to enact laws to protect the public. And in that responsibility, one shouldn't shrug their shoulders and say, oh, it's too out of control already. There's nothing we can do about it. That's irresponsible. And so I support the effort of the legislature to look at various ways to, within the limitations set by the Constitution, to protect people from the harm that's unquestionably done as a result of folks utilizing firearms.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking with the Attorney General of Illinois, Kwame Raoul. We taped this conversation last week, and so we're not taking calls live, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. So, Mr. Attorney General, I also wanted to ask you, another law your office is defending in court relates to the elimination of cash bail for people who have been accused of crimes but who have not yet had their day in court. You were present in the Supreme Court chambers earlier this month when that case went before the justices. Can you talk about why you think that law is constitutional, why it should be upheld?
Yeah, sure thing. The plaintiffs in the case, which were primarily some state's attorneys, from various counties, were hanging their hat on this notion that in the bail provision of our state constitution that provides for defendants to be bailable by sufficient sureties, they make the argument that means
cash. And I'll just say, I had to look that up. That basically just means guarantees. People shall be bailable by guarantees. Sorry to interrupt you.
Exactly. And so it's a broad term that can encompass various options, including cash bail. So it sets a broad floor that can be defined by the legislature. And I think our Deputy Solicitor General did a fabulous job of making clear that there's no explicit language in the state constitution that says you got to have cash bail as an option. And so there are various things such as electronic monitoring, home confinement, various things that can be utilized to allow for sufficient for satisfying the bail provision in the Constitution. They additionally made an argument on a theory of separation of powers that there's a case called Hemingway that speaks to judges having the inherent authority to be able to detain a defendant pretrial for the purpose of public safety or making certain that the individual is not a flight risk. There's nothing in the Safety Act that eliminates that authority that a judge can have. In fact, a judge can still detain somebody based on the notion of there being a threat to public safety. And so I feel fairly confident that the Supreme Court will overturn the decision made at the trial court level and uphold the pretrial detention provisions of the Safety Act.
Just to make sure before we're in the weeds. That's okay. This is public radio. We can get into the weeds a little bit, but just to make sure I'm understanding it, especially about that argument about the state constitution, the people who are challenging this law say when the word bailable is in by sufficient sureties in the constitution or guarantees, that means money in their view. And what I hear you saying is it just means people should be able to get bail unless they're charged with one of these much more serious charges. I saw speculation. Someone said, well, what if the legislature made bail a penny or the presumption of bail one penny or a dollar or something like that? Is that, a way around this law? I wonder what you think of that.
That would be within the legislature's discretion, right? The arguments that were trying to be made, that were made by some of the state's attorneys, were suggesting that the legislature couldn't place any type of limits on what we allow judges to do in the criminal process of criminal procedure. It's done all the time. There are mandatory minimums, there are maximums, there are sentencing ranges. And so this notion that somehow the legislature cannot put parameters around things is truly flawed, because it happens all the time.
We need to take a break in about a minute on our program here, but I do want to ask, there's a sort of big picture argument about this law not being litigated in court, but we certainly saw it litigated during the election season last year. And that's that people will say this law makes Illinoisans less safe.
Well, it's really disturbing, the misinformation that has surrounded this law. You had people even saying that the law increased crime within the state of Illinois when the law hadn't even gone into effect yet. The reality about it is the ability to detain somebody who's a danger to the public still exists. Nothing in the law, the notion that whether or not cash bail is provided as an option was a determinative thing that kept people safe is nonsense. Because somebody who is, let's say, a drug dealer who may have access to a lot of cash, could post a bond, right, and be free. And meanwhile, somebody who might be charged with a low-level offense that is not a violent offense at all, but is poor, would often be detained in pretrial for longer periods than they would even be sentenced to incarceration, if sentenced at all. It was not unusual to have people spend more time in county jail then they would be ultimately sentenced. Many people who would be sentenced to supervision or probation were already punished with a term of pretrial detention, simply not because they were a threat to public safety or a flight risk, but simply because they couldn't post bond. They couldn't post the cash, and that doesn't make any sense.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening to my interview with Attorney General Kwame Raoul, which we taped last week. We need to take a break. When we return, more with the Attorney General on the broader state of criminal justice reform, as well as the issue of so-called constitutional sheriffs. Before the break, I do want to mention a few of the other stories we're working on for later this week. Coming up tomorrow on Wednesday, we'll have sort of a halftime report of the Illinois General Assembly. They're about midway through their spring session. We'll talk with a pair of State House reporters about what lawmakers have been working on in Springfield. Plus, a look at the concept of 15-minute cities. This is the idea where one should be able to get pretty much everything you need within 15 minutes of your house. There's a city in southern Illinois that is pursuing this idea. More to come with the Attorney General of Illinois, Kwame Raoul, after a short break. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are listening to my conversation with Attorney General Kwame Raoul. We recorded this last week. We're bringing it to you today. We're not taking calls live, but you can always let us know what you thought by leaving a voicemail anytime at 217-300-2121. Before the break, we were talking about a number of the legal challenges to laws in Illinois, the bail, the elimination of cash bail was one of them. The assault weapons law was another. There's another one that just came up recently, and this is to a somewhat older law passed more than a decade ago, and that's the Torture Inquiry and Relief Commission. You were a champion and a sponsor of this law when you were a state senator. It was intended to take a hard look at the many cases of people wrongly convicted, or at least potentially wrongly convicted, after being tortured by the police, particularly a Chicago police detective. The law is now being challenged by the very lawyers who have been tasked with carrying it out and who have been billing for it, I saw one commenter noting. What do you make of this sudden challenge?
It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. The theory is that, again, I believe a separation of powers theory, that somehow the judge's discretion is infringed upon. The reality is the Torture Inquiry Relief Commission simply refers cases to the judiciary, to the courts, and the courts retain their discretion to decide on those cases as they wish. And so, I fail to see the logic in the challenge. And I've seen reports of, the hours that have been billed by these special prosecutors. It's concerning that the public is being billed to make such a, what I think at this point is, we're reviewing it, a non-meritorious argument on the constitutionality of a commission that's existed for well over a decade.
Has the commission worked as you hoped it would?
I mean, there have been periods of time, and I haven't, scrutinized it in great detail, to be honest with you. But there's been periods of time, certainly, where the commission was not funded. And obviously, it's difficult for any entity to function if it's not adequately funded, or in certain instances, not funded at all. With all that said, I confess I can't say that I have really reviewed any data on how well the commission has worked.
The last sort of legal challenge I want to ask you about is this push among so-called constitutional sheriffs. This is the idea that sheriffs have some special role in our system of government to interpret the Constitution, never mind Marbury against Madison in the U.S. Supreme Court 200 years ago. What do you make of this push to sort of sheriffs to declare themselves independent arbiters of what is and is not constitutional in Illinois? And it's really a national movement.
Yes, it's a dangerous trend. Certainly, whether sheriffs or police chiefs and police officers and prosecutors, all to some extent possess a certain discretion as they carry out their oath to enforce the criminal laws. And you know, I'm not at all advocating that you have to eliminate that discretion that has long existed to make judgments on a case-by-case basis as to how they're enforced. However, we have a system here in this country where legislatures put criminal laws on the books, and it's the responsibility of law enforcement officers and prosecutors to enforce those laws in the interest of public safety. And I think that's a responsibility that every sort of chief law enforcement officer should carry out seriously within their respective local jurisdictions.
All this is driving at this, where our criminal justice system stands today. And I look back at the last decade, right? It began with Governor Quinn's election campaign in 2010, really hinging a lot on some of these get tough on crime policies. He was criticized for that. And then the Illinois prison population swelled to its biggest ever point in the early 20-teens. And then there was this real push for reform and Republican Governor Bruce Rauner and support from conservative groups like the Illinois Policy Institute and Right on Crime. And there was this commission that you were a member of to develop a more fair and humane criminal justice system. And all that culminates in the work of that commission and then George Floyd and the protests for racial justice in 2020 and the Safety Act. And now we seem to be in this period of backlash. What is your perspective on what happened to the bipartisan cooperation on this difficult political issue of criminal justice reform?
Yeah, I really struggle with the fact that in our nation, public opinion sways like a pendulum. As you mentioned, on the heels of George Floyd's murder, the vast majority of the nation undeniably held the position that that was a circumstance that was unjust and reflective of a larger problem. When one looks at the video of George Floyd's murder, even the most tough on crime conservative perspectives, people looked at it and saw that it was unjust. However, if there was no video, if that 17-year-old girl didn't tape it, we wouldn't have the level of self-reflection that we had on the heels of that murder. And I said it at the time that the further away we got from George Floyd's death, the less we would have people self-reflecting on reforms that we have to initiate to make sure that we have a just system that treats everybody equitably. And sure enough, the mood is different nowadays, and there's a return to this sense that we've got to embrace any and everything that can be perceived to be tough on crime instead of being smart and making sure that we do what keeps people safe and what's equitable at the same time.
In preparation for our conversation today, I was looking over some of my notes from one of those commission meetings. This was in November 2015 at Adler University in Chicago. You and the other commissioners were debating whether to make the crime of unlawful use of a weapon a felony, or I should say to make it probational, I think. The details aren't important. Something you said, though, struck me. And you said, I think this goes to the heart of what we're doing here, looking at individualized treatment of offenders. Right? To quote the great philosopher Ted Lasso, all people are different people. Is that still the heart of the criminal justice debate in Illinois, in America today?
Unfortunately, it's not. And there's this reflexive feeling, and I understand it. You know, when we see a rise in crime and you see sort of chaotic, violent acts being committed, whether it's carjackings or shootings in public, there's a reflexive sort of feeling that we've got to get tough on crime and approach it by one size fits all type of policy. When the reality is, if you take possession of a weapon, illegal possession of a weapon into consideration, not all the circumstances are identical. You could have somebody, you know, hypothetically, who may have been guilty of a felony decades ago and who hasn't partook in any criminal behavior, is working hard and, say, has a night shift job and is fearful and decides to carry a weapon for self-protection. And you could have a circumstance where that person encounters law enforcement. Are they to be treated the same as somebody who's a gang enforcer or a carjacker? I think most people would say no. However, they're both guilty of illegally possessing a weapon. The individualized treatment of offender would allow for more discretion to treat those two offenders differently.
Attorney General Kwame Raoul, thank you for taking the time to be with us on the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me.